dangerous feeling. Also, his gear looked particularly shiny and, as Boxy found out recently, shiny things were expensive. Owning expensive things meant he must have had the money to buy them, which in turn meant he was probably a successful adventurer. And successful adventurers were the kind of monster hunting experts who stood a real chance of defeating an uppity box that had gone in over its head. Eventually, the mimic decided against attacking the two and skulked away towards its initial destination. If either of those two were alone, then it would have definitely ambushed them. However, if they were together and it failed to take down the healer on the first strike, then its chances of winning that fight became close to zero. At that point, it would have to retreat or lose its life. So, rather than gamble on a fight it wasn't certain it would win, it decided to avoid it completely and go hunt far more predictable prey like its fellow monsters instead. Having made it to the edge of the troll woods about an hour later, the mimic forcibly dismissed both Cora and Zira, who were currently still in the city, and summoned them to its new position as backup. It briefly considered doing this to get a drop on the two potential targets earlier, but quickly deemed that to be a terrible idea. The summon familiar skill was quite flashy, so using it in the open fields just outside the city wall was a good way of getting itself noticed. Not only by the people in question, but also by the sentries atop the wall. The three of them set off into the thick woods, looking for a bouncewood tree. Finding one only took about 5 minutes since the mimic was already familiar with their shape, as this was far from its first visit to these parts. The tree's surface was black and smooth, just like the quest said, and the reason for that was because its bark was essentially a form of natural rubber. Its appearance was also closer to that of an oversized palm tree than a pine or oak tree, although that little detail was well outside the purview of the mimic's understanding of botany. The combination of the strange plant's bark and shape made it bouncy, stretchy, and resilient, which made it an interesting component that could be useful to artificers. Boxy decided it would collect a few extra kilograms for itself, in addition to what was necessary for the quest. However, it soon found out exactly why this seemingly easy quest had not been taken by someone else earlier. Stripping away that bark was hard. It was impact-resistant to the point where Cora's punches and kicks had absolutely no effect and merely bounced off. Trying to put her entire weight and power behind a double haymaker punch also proved to be useless. While her blow was a magnificent hit that would snap most trees in half, this one simply bent over. It then bounced back, making a weird boing sound, and slapped Cora on the forehead, knocking her off her feet. The tree swayed back and forth a few times before returning to its original position without suffering so much as a scratch. Zira was also quite useless. She could, of course, set fire to it, but burning the bark they were here to collect defeated the purpose of the exercise. In the end, Boxy transformed the tip of its tongue into a hand axe using metal mimicry and started hacking away at it. The tough material dented and dulled the hand axe surprisingly quickly, even though it had the toughness of real steel. That wasn't much of a problem since Boxy could easily reshape it back to full sharpness, but it was still a frustrating chore. It took the mimic almost 15 minutes of frantically hacking away at the relatively thin but incredibly annoying bouncewood tree until it fell over. The tree's cross-section revealed that over 2/3 of it was nothing but rubber bark, which explained why it was so damned resilient. Boxy spent the next half hour or so stripping away and harvesting the bark, making sure to get big pieces when possible. It had a feeling those guys at the Mercenary Guild were bound to withhold part of its deposit if it tried to turn in 120 kilograms worth of rubber scraps. They'd already done that 2 days ago when it turned in 10 troll hides that were riddled with holes and cuts. The dwarven bartender named Grog was even able to tell they were left behind by some sort of irregularly shaped bite marks, though he wasn't able to determine what monster they belonged to. Which was good, considering the monster in question was standing right next to him. Once the tall, palm-like tree trunk was stripped of its bark, the mimic started putting it away into its storage. Once it had stowed away the last of it, it double-checked its quest's status. Collect 120 kilograms of bouncewood bark. Description: deliver 120 kilograms of bouncewood bark to the Mercenary Guild in the city of Erosa. Bouncewood trees may be found in the troll woods west of Erosa and are easily recognizable due to their smooth and black surface. Difficulty: 2 stars. Time limit, 3 days, 8 hours. Deposit, 100 GP. Reward, 100 GP. Progress, 0 out of 120. Well, that was odd. Usually the progress counter that tracked the completion rate of a quest's objective would update in real time, and Boxy was quite sure it stowed away at least 200 kilograms of the stuff by now. It was quite dense and heavy material, after all, so it shouldn't take a lot of volume to reach that sort of weight. Ah, but technically speaking, the objective was to deliver the stuff, not just gather it. Otherwise, it could legally get paid and then still keep the stuff for itself. As expected of the Mercenary Guild, their people knew how to avoid leaving obvious loopholes in their quests that would compromise their profits. Its business with this place was concluded, so the Mimic decided to leave the forest and go back to town before dawn came. As for its bound demons, they wouldn't fit in that narrow passage and had to be re-summoned every time Boxy crossed the wall. It was annoying, but it was better than trying to sneak a 2.5-meter-tall pile of rage and muscle through a small army of armed guards. Therefore, once the three of them were clear of the forest, the Mimic ordered its familiars to remain behind and went on its way. Almost immediately, it heard the loud noises their usual shenanigans made, but it didn't bother with them. Any monsters they attracted with that racket would be entirely their problem to deal with. As for Boxy, it was already speeding towards the city. The Troll Woods were at a much higher elevation, which meant that getting there from Erosa involved walking uphill for about an hour. Going back, however, was a gradual downward slope, which meant the Mimic could roll almost the entire way to town by using wheels instead of legs. The shape-shifting chest had already improved greatly upon its original design for the organic wheels. The complex limbs with a diameter of 60 centimeters now took only a few seconds to fully grow from scratch and no longer leaked like they used to. Granted, the ride along the uneven dirt was hardly comfortable, but it was hard to argue with the sort of speed the miniature murder wagon was picking up. It drastically reduced the time for its return trip, allowing the Mimic to cross the distance between the Troll Woods and Erosa 3 times faster than normal. It would probably get to its destination even faster, but it couldn't roll all the way there. Even Boxy understood that no amount of tall grass would be able to hide a chest rolling along at high speed. Even if humans normally couldn't see very well in the dark, it was relatively cheap to buy a helmet or a pair of spectacles with a night vision enchantment on them. So it was much safer to cross the last kilometer or so on foot. On its way back, the Mimic once again spied the nun and her protector out in the wilderness, in the same area they'd been a few hours ago. However, it seemed the two of them had moved on from their flower-gathering mission to something else entirely. Something the Mimic had been witness to so many times in its short life that there was no way it wasn't familiar with it.
Ha! Yeah! Harder!
In short, the tall escort was currently on top of the nun and escorting himself into her rear entrance over and over. Taking it up the dirt road, as it were, didn't count as far as Sister Lyo's chastity vows were concerned, and she was far from the only one who skirted them in such a manner. She had technically been truthful with the guard, though she still masked her real reason for coming out here. It was fine, though. Tuer was human, and she would be forgiven for playing fast and loose with her oaths so long as she sang a few hymns and said a few prayers. Easing her guilty conscience would come later. As for right now, she really needed some stress relief away from prying eyes. Unfortunately for her, she failed to take into account that the act in question left both her and her escort naked, distracted, and with their backs wide open to attack. Assassination skill triggered. Your attack has dealt 350% more damage. Target HP minus 753. You have dealt a devastating blow. Target stunned for 5 seconds. Assassination skill triggered. Your attack has dealt 350% more damage. Target HP minus 914. You have slain your target in a single strike. Assassination proficiency increased. Honestly, it was like the pair were begging to be stabbed. Part 6.
See? I smeggin' told you so!
The young and much too green guard gave a wide smile. He was obviously proud of himself. Or full of himself, depending on one's point of view.
Fine, shouted the older guard in frustration. I admit you were right.
Those five words almost felt like someone stabbing him in the gut with a pitchfork. And Guardsman Thomas had hands-on experience with that particular sensation. It was indeed as unpleasant as it sounded.
Now would you kindly shut the fuck up about it, he grumbled.
Ha!
Scoffed the rookie.
I'll shut up when you pay up. All right, here.
Thomas reached into his pocket and brought out a king piece, which was an extra-large gold coin worth 50 GP. He handed it over resentfully to the cocky youngster.
Hope you choke on it. Ha ha! Come on, man, don't be so bitter. It was fair game and you know it. Yeah, yeah, whatever you say. I still say you cheated somehow.
The two guardsmen had made a friendly bet. The younger one, Shaw, insisted he could do a backflip while wearing the full plate armor that had become standard issue for all of Eros's guards. The squirt could barely even move in it properly when he signed up 5 days ago, yet he still pulled off the backflip like it was nothing. The explosive growth obtained from power leveling was indeed frightening. With their bit of fun concluded, the two resumed keeping an eye on the empty streets just inside the city's northern gate. Of course, such frivolity was normally looked down upon, but these men understood that a little bit of excitement was sometimes necessary to keep the mind alert. That held especially true during these boring night shifts, and the four guards stationed nearby agreed completely. Still, they had jobs to do and wages to earn, so they kept the distractions to a minimum. An hour or so later, the sky started lighting up, signifying the approach of dawn, and with it would also come Thomas's replacement. However, instead of being elated, the middle-aged guard felt a sense of disquiet. Sister Lyo, who he had known for several years, had gone out on another trip to gather moon blossoms. This had been going on for about 3 weeks and had become a routine. She always said she stuck around the relatively safe grasslands immediately to the west of the city, and she always had that tall stranger with her for protection. Last night was the first time she identified him as her cousin, though Thomas didn't think much of it at the time. It wasn't like he had asked her about their relation, so he had no grounds to complain. However, the pair were taking entirely too long. Usually they'd only be gone for a few hours, but that time had long since passed. Thomas had asked her about needing extra protection. If they turned up missing or even dead... No, he couldn't think that way. He had to believe they were all right, that they merely got caught up in something and would return shortly. Unfortunately, Sister Lyo and her bodyguard did not return before the end of his shift. His replacement came to take over his post at dawn, and Thomas was then supposed to return to the barracks. Part of him wanted to stay and keep an eye out for her, but that wouldn't solve anything. And he would get in deep shit if he failed to check in his arms and armor on time. He'd heard what happened to some deserters that tried to pull a fast one and abscond with the expensive items, and unlike those people, Thomas liked his head attached to the rest of his body. He trudged off towards the barracks in the middle of the city along with the rest of his shiftmates. Shaw still had a cocky grin on his face due to winning that 50 GP bet and was already bragging about how he would spend it all at the nearest pub. Thomas had no such desires right now. He was way too tired and had too much on his mind to deal with rowdy rookies. Having young blood like them around was reassuring in case shit went down, but their attitude could use some serious adjustment. As for an old dog like Thomas, he had long ago found out it was best to ignore the things he couldn't do anything about and focus on the ones he could. Which right now amounted to checking in his gear, reporting the missing persons, and getting some shut-eye. Even if he was worried about the young nun, he surely wouldn't be the only one. The temple was bound to organize a search party once they heard one of their own had gone missing. Experience told him their return was highly unlikely, but some part of him still clung to the hope that Sister Lyo and her cousin would...
Ugh!
A shadow passed over Thomas, sending an unnatural chill down his spine. Turning around, he spotted a large, cloaked, familiar-looking figure walking along the middle of the mostly deserted street.
Hey! Hey!
He called out.
Hey, you! Big guy in the cloak!
Stop right there!
The over 2-meter-tall man froze and turned around to face him. His head was wrapped in a blue cloth, and the heavy black cloak obscured his form. What little could be seen of his face was sickly pale, and his yellow eyes seemed to lick over Thomas as if tasting him. In one arm, he carried a heavy-looking bag that bulged out slightly from beneath his cloak. The guardsman blinked a few times in surprise. What was he thinking? This clearly wasn't the cousin from last night. Sure, the size was similar, but that was pretty much it. Even if he couldn't see the face, it was obvious this wasn't the same person.
I apologize. My mistake. Carry on, citizen.
The stranger nodded in response and went about his way. Thomas watched the hooded figure absent-mindedly until it disappeared into the nearby building belonging to the mercenary guild. Now that he thought about it, didn't that guy seem suspicious? That bad feeling he gave off was... Thomas shook his head to throw off his errant thoughts. His tired, worried mind was probably playing tricks on him, to think he accosted a random pedestrian like that. Thankfully, none of the other passers-by appeared to think badly of him, and some even seemed to say, "Go on, arrest that freak," with their eyes. He was far too tired to deal with some mysterious stranger, though. Not to mention the trouble he'd get into if he randomly arrested someone on a whim. Having decided that rest was his top priority, he jogged up the street to catch up with his younger colleagues and continued on his way towards the barracks. Once there, he checked in his gear, reported the absence of Sister Lyo and her bodyguard, crawled into his bunk, and slept the sleep of the dead just as planned. He woke up about 6 hours later at high noon and went to have luckfast, a combination of lunch and breakfast, not to be confused with brunch. Once his hunger was properly satiated and his hazy mind cleared up, he left the barracks and went into the keep proper. He wanted to see his direct superior and ask if there had been any sign of Sister Lyo. Thomas had been the one to file the missing persons report earlier, and he was one of the last few people to see her alive. So he felt it was his responsibility to see this case through to the end. The guardsman climbed up the stone steps inside the keep, up to the third floor. He walked down one hallway, then another, and finally a third before reaching his destination.
"Enter!"
came a clear voice from the other side of the door. Thomas quickly opened it and walked inside. The office itself was nothing extraordinary, just a desk, a few chairs, and a whole lot of cabinets. Sitting behind the desk, scribbling on a piece of paper, was a slightly overweight, balding man with a goatee. The out-of-uniform guardsman walked up to the foot of the desk and saluted.
"Lieutenant Porkins, sir. Guardsman Thomas requesting a moment of your time, sir."
The man with the oddly fitting name put down his quill and looked up.
"Guardsman Thomas, eh?"
"Yes, sir. I'm here to inquire about the missing person. Lyo Rosetta, sir."
"Are you?"
Porkins raised an eyebrow.
This is good. Excellent timing, actually. I was just about to have someone send for you regarding that matter. Have a seat."
He gestured at the empty chair opposite the desk, which the simple guardsman respectfully took.
"Thank you, sir."
"Now then,"
said Porkins, putting away the document he was working on.
"As I'm sure you've already guessed, the local Temple of Teresa immediately organized and sent out a search party in response to your report. They've been scouring the area north and west of the city all the way to the Troll Woods, but there has been no sign of her or this cousin of hers."
"Nothing at all, sir."
"No, guardsman. Not a trace of her or that swordsman. It's like they disappeared in a puff of smoke."
That was unusual. Thomas was sure Lyo was at least a level 40 priestess, and it was quite obvious that muscle-bound juggernaut of a bodyguard would not go down easily. There ought to have been at least some signs of a struggle if a fight had broken out.
"That is unsettling, sir."
"Indeed. Tell me, guardsman, how long have you known the young Miss Rosetta?"
"About 3 years, sir. 4 this summer."
"And were you too close?"
"Not particularly, sir. I'd say we were more than acquaintances, but not quite friends, sir."
After all, A gate guardsman and a nun have very little interaction aside from seeing each other in passing every so often. Thomas was a somewhat devout man, so he made sure to treat clergy like her with extra care and respect, but that was about the gist of it.
And her cousin? Only seen him a few times these past few weeks, sir. We haven't exchanged words. I didn't even know he was her cousin until she mentioned it last night, sir.
Did she actually say that, though?
Pardon, sir?
What were her exact words, guardsman?
Thomas thought back to that meeting, trying to recall as many details as he could. Well, the encounter had been more or less the only highlight of the night, so it wasn't that difficult a task.
I believe her exact words were, "I trust my cousin with my life, sir."
And you didn't feel the presence of taboo after she said that?
No, sir.
She was a priestess sworn in service to Teresa. If she had told a lie, Thomas was sure he would have instantly felt the taboo from her. Merely looking at someone branded with that heretic's mark of a skill made his skin crawl. A truly disgusting, unsettling feeling, as if looking at a rat or a cockroach crawling around in the filth.
I see. But she did not explicitly state that the man present was her cousin, did she?
Porkins had a point. Lyo had stated that she trusted her cousin, not that the man next to her was her cousin.
Permission to speak freely, sir?
Granted.
What is going on?
The lieutenant's tone of voice suggested he had some misgivings about this missing person that went beyond simple concern.
I suppose if anyone deserves to know, it's you. You are involved in this, after all.
Porkins leaned forward and put his elbows on top of the desk.
I had a meeting with the bishop from Teresa's temple a few hours ago. We had words at length about our missing nun. It appears she had been acting strangely these last few weeks, ever since that stranger showed up. Our investigation of her personal effects this morning revealed she does indeed have a cousin, but that person should be living on the other side of the country right now.
In other words, while she didn't lie, she didn't exactly reveal the truth, either.
The thing is,
continued Porkins,
I can forgive her for wanting to keep her affairs private. I've always felt it was unfair for those people to be prohibited from keeping even the tiniest of secrets. However, her disappearance yesterday happened with some interesting timing.
Timing, sir?
Porkins nodded. That was when Thomas finally realized what the lieutenant was getting at. A valuable treasure had disappeared from the Temple of Teresa. A nun serving in that very same temple left the city several hours afterwards and vanished without a trace. She even had a hunky, well-armed bodyguard with her. Someone she intentionally misled others to believe was her relative. And all this happened during a time of civil unrest caused by an incomprehensible disaster, which was bound to drive sane people to do stupid things out of their misguided fear. It didn't take a genius to connect those dots and paint a picture of a disillusioned nun robbing her temple and running off with some forbidden lover.
Oh, shit,
cursed Thomas.
A whole cartload of it.
Porkins agreed.
Just keep your conclusions to yourself, guardsman. We really cannot afford to have people start questioning the temples. Or even worse, having the goddess herself question us.
The overweight officer sighed and sat back in his chair. He rubbed his temple, suggesting this affair was giving him no end of troubles.
Our official stance at this point is that they're merely missing persons. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Of course, Thomas understood why such things had to be done. He didn't like it, but it was a necessary measure. Besides, he felt like he had no room to comment. After all, the suspect had slipped away under his watch. Was he perhaps too trusting for this sort of work? No, that wasn't it. If he couldn't even trust the word of a servant of Teresa, then he'd probably be a failure as a human being.
Good. Your cooperation is appreciated, guardsman. Take the rest of the day off. Dismissed.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Thomas stood up, saluted once more, and exited the office. He passed by the lieutenant's new assistant on the way out and exchanged greetings. His gaze lingered on her for several seconds. It was uncharacteristic of him, but he couldn't help himself. Something about that girl just seemed to demand his attention. It was probably the combination of her beautiful face, enormous rack, and plump ass, all wrapped up in that tight uniform. Wait, was that why the lieutenant hired her a few days ago? Nah, couldn't be. Porkins was a happily married and dutiful man. If he hired her, then it was probably for her ability rather than her looks.
Yes,
he thought.
Probably.
Thomas shook away the improper thoughts. His superior officer's personal life really wasn't high on his list of priorities. Having been given some time off so suddenly, he decided to go for a walk around town. He rarely had the chance to just relax these days, since he was either on duty or drilling the new recruits. They could have at least bumped his pay if they were going to dump those kids on his shoulders. Ah, but they did technically up his pay a week ago, didn't they? Guess he had no more room for...
Ah!
There it was again. A vague feeling of panic out of nowhere that caused the hair on his neck to stand on end. Looking back, Thomas once again saw that looming cloaked figure, the one he'd earlier mistook for Lio's cousin. The off-duty guard watched curiously as the figure walked off, leaving him keenly aware that this bizarre sensation was not just his imagination. So what was it then? The feeling he gave off was distinctly different from Taboo, yet equally unpleasant. Maybe some other strange skill he had? Come to think of it, he was one of those mercenary guild types, and what little could be seen of his skin looked terrible. Maybe it was a curse of some sort? Or some strange disease? Would it really be safe to let someone like that walk around town?
It wouldn't hurt to be prudent.
He decided to follow the man, just in case. The guy's huge stride was difficult for Thomas to follow without breaking out into a light run, though at the same time it was nearly impossible to lose him in the crowd. Thomas was also in his casual off-duty clothes, which made him look like just another citizen instead of a guard. He followed his target for a good 10 minutes before it reached its destination, an old storefront with a cracked and dirty window. The suspect put a bandaged, pale hand on the door and pushed it open with a slight ringing noise, then stepped inside. Thomas looked at the store's exterior. The sign over the door caught his attention.
"Fizzy's Fidgety Widgets," he read aloud. "Huh. I'm sure I've heard about it before."
Erosa was by no means a small city. Even someone who had lived there his whole life would be hard-pressed to say he knew every store in town. In fact, Thomas only knew about 6 of them, since they were the only ones he visited regularly, and 2 of them were pubs. So how come he knew about this one? It didn't seem like the type of place he would shop at. However, the curious guard hadn't managed to recall where he'd heard the name by the time the masked man walked out of the shop a few minutes later. It felt like the answer was on the tip of his tongue, but his thoughts came to a screeching halt when he saw that his suspect was no longer alone. A little girl with bright pink hair done up in twin pigtails and wearing old work clothes was riding on the guy's shoulders, with his neck between her legs.
"Eek!"
she squealed as she fastened her grip on the tall stranger's head.
"Want off?"
asked the cloaked man in a deep, clear voice.
"No, I'll be fine. It's just, much higher than I thought it would be."
"Okay."
The pair set off, walking in no particular direction. Fizzy's unease gradually lessened as Boxy walked around and she realized this was a far smoother ride than she was expecting. Truth be told, she hadn't been expecting anything. She had just let out a "must be nice being so tall" comment while the two were making small talk, which somehow escalated into this current situation. The gnome had no idea what caused her student to suggest this or why it was so insistent, but she'd be lying if she said she wasn't curious. And now that she was up here, she couldn't help but feel astonished. She had been to tall places before, of course, but this was the first time she had been atop a moving one. The streets that Boxy walked through were the same old town section of Erosa she had grown up in, but her new vantage point made everything seem fresh and exciting. Even those scary-looking adventurers that came from out of town seemed far less threatening from up here. She felt strangely safe, almost like she was a mouse riding on the back of a lion. A metaphor that was much closer to reality than she thought. The gnome had, however, gotten too complacent. She was leaning over to her left, trying to get a good look at the top of a passing adventurer's fancy-looking hat. Boxy made an abrupt right turn while she was off balance, causing her to lose her grip and slip off her perch, kicking and screaming. She was deftly caught by her student's massive hands and silently put back in her seat. Fizzy wasn't hurt, but the embarrassment of that childish display had finally made her settle down, much to Boxy's relief. The sideways chest had grown supple shoulders specifically to support her rump, but it feared her fidgeting might make her bump into the knotwood frame hidden beneath its disguise. It was hence a very good thing there were no further incidents for the remainder of the excursion. The horribly mismatched pair's walk lasted for about 20 minutes in total before Boxy returned to Fizzy's storefront. It crouched low to the ground, allowing its passenger to safely hop off its neck.
"Wow! That was so much fun!"
exclaimed Fizzy, with a bright smile on her face. She was practically hopping in place with glee.
"Well, aside from the whole falling part. But yeah, I really needed that. Thank you so much!"
Boxy gave her a massive thumbs up, then waved goodbye as it turned around to go on its way.
"Wait! You forgot your stuff in the shop!"
the gnome called out. The lumbering monster very nearly let out a yelp. It had been so engrossed in what it was doing that it nearly neglected the reason it came here in the first place. Strictly speaking, the whole bonding thing with Fizzy was something it decided to do on the spot after remembering a valid point Snack had brought up earlier that day. The mimic desperately needed to work on its social skills, lest it create a situation where a memory wipe would not be sufficient. And since Boxy learned best by doing, it ended up just going for it when the opportunity presented itself. It was a bit risky, but it all worked out rather well. The gnome's excellent mood was ample evidence of that. Her accidental fall and the mimic's timely catch probably scored quite a few points. It felt quite satisfied with its performance as it picked up the blue toolbox it had come here to get and set off for its current lair. However, completely unbeknownst to the monster, Thomas the guardsman had been following it around the entire time. This wasn't the old dog's first stakeout, so he knew how to tail a suspect without being noticed. He honestly didn't know what to think about that whole shoulder-riding thing, but it all looked wrong from his point of view. Not only because of the creepy feeling the tall stranger gave off, but also because that pink-haired girl did not seem to notice anything was amiss. Thomas stalked the cloaked wanderer for another quarter hour, but ended up losing him when he started ducking into some alleys towards the slums. Well, that was to be expected. Those narrow, twisting paths almost seemed designed to shake off pursuers, and that shady-looking fellow was much nimbler on his feet than one might think. The diligent guard wouldn't be dissuaded so easily, though. Maybe he was just being a busybody, but he refused to ignore that clearly suspicious punk. When did such a person even arrive here? Thomas was sure he'd remember a conspicuous shape like that if it ever passed through the gate he was stationed at. Then again, that only accounted for one of two entrances into the city, and it wasn't like Thomas was there all day every day. It was not unlikely that the two just hadn't crossed paths until today's two chance meetings. So what about this suspect of his? What sort of person was he? What was his reason for being here? And for that matter, when exactly did he show up around town? These were all very good questions, and the truth could usually be gleaned by asking those who interacted with the suspect on a daily basis. The Mercenary Guild adamantly protected all their employees' information, so visiting them without a warrant was pointless. This courtesy also extended towards any outsourced employees they did business with, and those people were pretty damn good at doing business, so it was unlikely they'd cough up any information. At least not without an appropriately sized bribe, but the guard disliked giving any money to those vultures unless absolutely necessary. There were always the vendors who ran the street stalls where the masked man had stopped to buy a disturbing amount of meat Then again, they were probably complete strangers, judging by their startled reactions when he loomed over them. In the end, Thomas's only course of action was to question the one person who seemed even remotely close to the guy. He retraced his steps back to Fizzy's fidgety widgets and stood in front of the door. He had been racking his brains trying to remember what this place was for most of the past hour. Seeing the owner earlier helped greatly in that regard, as he was able to recall this was the only gnomish-run establishment in Erosa. The owner was supposed to be an old coot with a few screws loose, but it didn't take a leap of logic to determine the girl in question was his daughter. He could have sworn there was something else he was forgetting. But if he didn't remember it by now, it wasn't going to come to him any time soon. So he decided to stop wasting time and enter the shop. The interior of the store was, to put it simply, pure chaos. Random contraptions were strewn about, and there were even some loose nuts and bolts rolling around on the floor. There also appeared to be a series of dents, scratches, and cracks all over the place. Something violent had obviously transpired here, and recently at that.
"Just a minute!"
The owner's squeaky voice came from the slightly ajar door in the corner, and the gnome showed herself shortly afterwards.
"Did you forget something else, but... Oh! Sorry, wrong person."
Her cheerful voice turned deadpan and monotone when she lifted the goggles from her eyes and noticed the man in her store was not the one she expected.
"Cammy Fizzlespunk, right?"
Thomas hazarded a guess at the gnome's name. He had been trying to remember it for a while now, but this was the closest he'd gotten. Which, judging from the gnome's long, drawn-out sigh, had been a miss.
"Well, at least he got the initials right,"
she mumbled under her breath.
"The name's Corny Fizzlesprocket, but you can just call me Fizzy."
"Right. Sorry about that."
"It's okay. You humans never get my name right anyway. Well, most of you don't, at any rate."
The gnome set down the tools in her hands, removed her gloves and goggles, and assumed her position behind the counter.
"So, what can I help you with?"
I actually wanted to inquire about the tall gentleman in the heavy cloak who was here about half an hour ago."
The gnome's eyes instantly narrowed to slits.
"Who's asking?"
"City guard."
"You don't look like no guard."
"That's because I'm off duty."
"Uh-huh. Well, Mr. Off Duty, if you're not going to buy anything, then leave."
In retrospect, he really should have expected this sort of treatment. He'd be suspicious, too, if some random old man showed up on his doorstep claiming to be a guard and asking questions. At the same time, he couldn't just leave empty-handed, as that would mean he'd wasted most of the afternoon off on a wild goose chase.
"Look, I just want to ask a few things about the man. I don't mean any..."
"Get out!"
the gnome said coldly.
"Huh?"
Fizzy brought out a weird device from under the counter. Its main body was that of a thick metal tube, dyed black. It had a crossbow-like grip with a trigger on one end, and a short metal rod tipped with a tiny blue ball protruding from the other end. There were also a number of odd metal protrusions sticking out of it. She was holding it with two hands and pointing the rounded end directly at her rude visitor.
"But I..."
stammered Thomas. The gnome flicked one of the many switches on the contraption. Various bits and pieces on the device lit up, and an audible buzzing came out of the rounded tip, accompanied by a few white sparks.
"I said out!"
she repeated in a clearly threatening manner. Thomas didn't know what the device was, but surely even a gnome wasn't nutty enough to attack someone in broad daylight, right? Granted, this was private property and she was technically within her rights to refuse service to anyone, but common sense dictated that violence really should not be necessary in this instance. He raised his hands in the air, trying to show he bore no hostility.
"Please calm down, ma'am. I just want to know when..."
A miniature arc of electricity flew out of the device with a flash and zapped the fingertips on Thomas's right hand, electrocuting him for 10 HP worth of damage.
"Ow!"
he yelled, recoiling from the sudden jolt.
"You won't get another warning shot,"
Fizzy said, still keeping the device trained on him. She turned a dial on the side, causing the thing in her arms to let out an alarming noise as miniature lightning bolts lit up the air around its front end.
"Out!"
she repeated.
"Now!"
"Okay, I'm going."
Fizzy kept pointing the weapon at the door for several seconds to make sure the nosy bastard had indeed gone away. She flipped the little lever on the side, changing its setting from stun to shock and finally to off. Her lightning thrower, an artificer-made weapon that did exactly what its name implied, spooled down and went quiet. There was also technically the vaporize setting, but Fizzy was wary of going that far. Unleashing the device's full power could kill someone or potentially break the thing for good. And right now, that second thing was not something she could allow to happen. She stared at the lightning thrower solemnly, almost reverently, and ran a finger across its slightly warm chassis.
"Dad,"
she muttered.
"Sorry about using Zapster on a worthless guy like that. I kind of lost it when that suspicious goon started asking questions about my star pupil."
A small smile spread across her lips.
"I bet you would have loved meeting Boxy. That guy is an enigma wrapped in a riddle with a side order of mystery. But I can tell he's a man who adores machines. He's weird, but in a good way, I think. And he's just as clever as any gnome. Huh. Give him enough time. He might just grow to be cleverer than you are."
Tears started trailing down her face.
"Than you were."
She hugged the weapon and began sobbing quietly.
"I miss you and Lark so much. Why? Why did you have to go off on that stupid trip? Why did you have to listen to some shady merchant's promises? Idiot! So what if the store is struggling? You're far more important than this shitty dump. Curse that damn snake of a man and his shitty money. Moron. Blockhead. Stupid."
Rory Fizzlesprocket was a level 70 Arclight artificer. He and his son, Lark, had left to visit the city of Monotol 3 weeks ago, aboard a merchant's private caravan. The same caravan that had reportedly been found wiped out and ransacked on the outskirts of the former city.
"Why did you have to leave me alone?"
Corny wept as she hugged the last memento of her dearly departed father and brother. It was hardly the best use for a delicate piece of high-powered weaponry. But what choice did she have? Those worthless humans couldn't even bring her a body to mourn. Part 7. Erosa's officials had put forth their utmost effort to keep the matter concerning a certain nun's disappearance a secret, but that proved to be in vain. It was now 8 days after that event, and pretty much the entire city of Erosa knew about it. A priestess in service to Teresa had abandoned her vows, stolen a holy pearl from the temple, and eloped into the night with a stranger. The cat was out of the bag. There was no way to contain the spread of such scandalous rumors once they found their way into the general populace. This worrisome information had just the right mix of fact and fantasy to make people unable to judge whether such a thing was true or not. The purported guilty party was nowhere to be seen, and their innocence could not be proclaimed with confidence by the temple or the guards. And so, rather than let them fester, the office of the city guard decided to take action. Bounty posters were made, and a generous reward of 2,000 GP was offered to anyone who brought forth news that would lead to the capture of Lyo Rosetta or her accomplice, a man identified as Alden Crawford. There was also an ongoing investigation to find out who leaked this particular information, but that was little more than a token effort. Word of mouth was an extremely unreliable trail to follow. Which was exactly what the person responsible for maliciously spreading that rumor was counting on. In fact, not only were they the one who manufactured this new widespread truth, but they were also the actual perpetrator behind the Holy Pearl theft that set this whole situation into motion. And this person did it all with an evil, shit-eating grin on her face. Truly a rotten piece of garbage that enjoyed watching humans flail about in their ignorance. As expected of a succubus with a monster for a master. Zira's reasons for doing all of this were, as per usual, entirely self-serving. She'd always hated that stuck-up bitch of a goddess called Teresa. Any succubus who knew of the deity shared her opinion. These conniving seductresses were basically the antithesis of everything that Teresa stood for. Her natural enemies, as it were. This sentiment was also echoed by pretty much all of demonkind. albeit to a lesser extent. Cora's completely unbiased opinion, for instance, was that the goddess symbolized by the hammer was in dire need of a good hammering, right in her divine parts. Zero was in somewhat of an agreement, but she had far more realistic goals in mind. The only way to mess with a divine being was to shake the faith of his or her followers, which was why she toyed with Teresa's flock at every opportunity. She would have no shortage of victims either, as that religion encompassed the vast majority of humanity and the Lodrak Empire as a whole. Which wasn't to say it was a monotheistic nation. The people of the Empire prayed to other gods as well, but Teresa's religion and its influence were by far the most prominent. So when the opportunity to screw with her divine frigidness presented itself, the succubus leapt on it with truly demonic fervor. And the results were, to put it in her master's words, really tasty. Not only did she make the populace of an entire city doubt one of Teresa's clergy with a widespread lie, but she also framed the poor nun for a crime that the demoness herself had committed, none of which would have been possible if Sister Lyo hadn't gotten too horny for her own good. It was the perfect concoction that was sure to make that self-righteous deity throw a hissy fit if she found out. That, however, was a very big if. After all, the gods were neither omnipotent or omniscient. They could draw power from the faith of their followers to perform miracles, but it could also be said that they were dependent on the mortal's devotion. The question regarding what would happen should a god or goddess lose every last one of their believers had been a controversial topic among the faithful since olden times. Would these deities simply disappear? Or would they instead be left powerless and lose their divinity? Or perhaps garnering faith was simply a way for them to enhance their already formidable power? Such secrets of the gods were very well kept, but their behavior throughout the centuries made one thing clear. They wanted to be worshipped. Which in turn meant that causing people to doubt them on a large scale was the best, and perhaps only, way to rattle their gilded cages. Realistically speaking, though, Zira's careful manipulations were unlikely to catch the notice of a big shot like Teresa. She had millions of worshippers, so losing a few thousand was unlikely to make any sort of dent. It was the thought that counted, though, and the succubus's machinations were enough to make her feel good about herself. And in the end, that was all that really mattered to her. Which wasn't to say her actions didn't have some more practical benefits. Forging and spreading that rumor around served as a good smokescreen for her master's activities. Authorities wouldn't be able to look into the background of some shady adventurer with a creepy atmosphere if they were too busy reassuring the populace. Meaning not only was Zira having fun, but she was also actively improving the chances her current arrangement would last at least a bit longer. Spreading that information was surprisingly easy, too, as humans sometimes put too much trust in their superiors. And while that trust was usually well-placed, it didn't account for a devious demoness worming her way into their command structure and poisoning their minds. The lieutenant, in particular, had been easy enough to sway with but a shake of her hips and a kiss on the lips. He eagerly hired her as his new assistant, which put her in a good spot to obtain all sorts of sensitive information. Spreading misinformation was quite easy, too. All she had to do was plant the right suggestion in the right head through her dreamweaver skill and watch the mortals flail around in their ignorance as they tried to work them out. After all, the greatest misunderstandings were those that men arrived at seemingly on their own. The temples were, unfortunately, less prone to supernatural manipulation. Sneaking into the building while pretending to be an out-of-town nun on a pilgrimage and absconding with one of their holy pearls was easy enough, but anything further than that would be ill-advised. Monks, priests, and paladins had skills that fortified them against mental attacks, as well as the power to cleanse such afflictions from others or themselves. That wasn't to say these holy men and women hated demons for wanting to spread misery, death, and destruction. That was like hating a fire for spreading in the woods or resenting the rain for causing a flood. The servants of the gods were naturally wary of unbound demons or those ordered to commit atrocities. But then again, so was everyone else. It was considered just another misuse of magical power, and a summoner was considered responsible for crimes carried out by their familiar. However, it was worth noting that the vast majority of such incidents were caused by ignorance rather than malice. Most warlocks that chose to use the power of a contracted demonic entity did so with well-meaning intentions. It was hard to deny that one could do great things if they correctly applied their familiar's abilities, but keeping a tight leash on a demon was harder than it sounded. That was why many warlocks opted to use beholders and hellhounds as their primary contracted servants. Fiends and stalkers were more impactful when it came to combat, but also much more difficult to keep in check, and far more dangerous should they be allowed to roam free. As for succubi, although their offensive magic was definitely potent, it was also technically their secondary feature. Suffice it to say that any adventurer who had one of these temptresses under their command would face a lot of ridicule and suspicion almost by default. All things considered, though, the number of people who opted to go the route of demon tamers was relatively small, accounting for barely a fifth of all warlocks. Most of them opted for the safer route of honing their arcane might and ruinous magic, which did not lose out to other caster jobs. As for the ones who opted for the riskier, and potentially more powerful, method of relying on demonic power, they were tolerated. Some of them were even recognized and lauded for their abilities to control their familiars to a fine degree, which was the exact opposite of what Boxy did. The mimic pretty much let its demons do as they pleased so long as they produced results and didn't inconvenience it. Its entire stance on the ethical ramifications of using malignant extra-dimensional entities could be summed up as such. Responsibility? Guilt? What are those? Are they tasty? They're not? Then I don't need them. Go bring me tasty things. This sort of careless outlook was why the shapeshifter continued its daily routine over the past week, willfully ignorant of the civil unrest its demons were causing. It began each morning by visiting the Mercenary Guild with the express purpose of taking on new quests or turning in finished ones for profit. After concluding its business there, Boxy would then move on to practicing its artisan job, either by itself or by taking lessons from Fizzy. So far it had made a plethora of mechanical contraptions that relied on clockwork expertise, such as a few dozen retractable blades of varying quality, 25 hand-sized clocks, 2 basic repeating crossbows, several pick-proof combination locks, and a disturbingly high number of music box toys. Selling these mechanical wonders proved to be remarkably easy, especially when it came to the better-than-average door locks or the plainly entertaining music boxes. These sales were the point where Boxy was finally able to recover a more sizable chunk of the money spent on parts, but it was still suffering a steady loss. It was worth it, however. The Mimic's Artificer job had gone all the way to level 12, which also unlocked the next skill in the series, explosives handling. Flashbangs and dynamite were the basic explosives that could be made based on this skill alone, but when combined with clockwork expertise, the Artificer could also give birth to several nasty surprises. Time-delayed explosives, pressure-activated landmines, and tripwire bombs were all within reach. There was even an evolution of the Blade Blossom called the Blade Boom. It worked much the same way as the original, only it used the power of blast powder rather than springs to form a rudimentary fragmentation grenade. But even though Boxy was improving steadily as an artificer, its warlock job was still stuck at level 25 and would stay that way for a while by the look of things. There existed 2 methods for raising the level cap of a people job. The first, easiest, and most commonly used method was to find a suitable teacher. For example, in order to become a level 1 artificer, Boxy had to find an artificer that was at least level 25 and had the mentor skill. This was a general access skill that anyone could acquire with enough time and practice, which facilitated training and teaching in all their forms. It was also mandatory if one hoped to pass on their jobs to others. Fizzy was overqualified for this position, but that wasn't a bad thing. Since she was a level 56 Arclight Artificer, she could also break the level 25 limit on Boxy's Tinkerer job, provided her mentor skill reached a level 4 by that point. One would then need to find a level 75 teacher with a level 7 mentor skill to break past 50, and a level 100 teacher with a level 10 mentor skill to progress above level 75. In other words, the Mimic had to find the appropriate warlock trainer if it wanted to further its only spell-slinging job. And therein lay the problem. The vast majority of combat-oriented job trainers all belonged to one guild or another and refused to teach anyone who wasn't part of their organization. And joining such an organization meant undergoing a full appraisal to verify one's capabilities by revealing their status. Needless to say, they would immediately reject Boxy's application when they found out it was a monster in disguise. The other method for furthering one's job was much more difficult and was known simply as a breakthrough. In order to accomplish this, an individual had to diligently train all of that job's unlocked skills until they reached the maximum level 10. A stringent and rigorous training regime would be necessary to achieve such a feat, and attempting this path was likely to take months, maybe even years, of hard work. There was also the hidden caveat that, while leveling these skills, it was highly unlikely for an adventurer to progress in job levels, leaving them in a bit of a rut. These things made many people shy away from such a path. Why would they spend an exorbitant amount of time like that on something easily achieved in an afternoon with the help of a trainer and a sack of gold? Even if achieving a breakthrough awarded a perk that boosted XP and skill proficiency for the related job by 10%, that was little more than a consolation prize. An adventurer would simply grow faster if they sought out a mentor, which was why this approach was reserved only for those who couldn't find a trainer or were unable to muster the fee. Thus, at least for the moment, Boxy's warlock job was stuck at level 25. Rather than obsess about it, the mimic decided to turn its attention towards improving the things it could. The artificer job was progressing steadily but seemed to require slightly more expensive components as time went on. Fizzy herself confirmed that the necessary raw material costs would steadily climb due to the scarcity or difficulty of obtaining those substances. Even with the discounts she gave her star pupil, it still proved to be a considerable strain on Boxy's wallet, and showed no sign of letting up. At least, not until Boxy decided it had had enough and cashed in on its investment. In the meantime, however, its mimic job had actually stagnated for a while. Boxy had spent perhaps too much time focusing on widgets and gadgets and not enough on murdering the crap out of things. Both that and its immediate monetary concerns could be solved by completing quests via the Mercenary Guild, which was why the monster was currently out here in the Whispering Marshes south of Erosa in the middle of the night. The area was a wide, depressing swampland that had formed as a result of the Whispering Canal's sprawling delta. The deep and narrow river became shallow and wide and split up into dozens of outlets as it approached the ocean. As a result, the entire place was perpetually wet, overgrown with reeds and tall grass, and always seemed to have a thick mist that limited visibility. The two main gripes adventurers had with it, however, was that it smelled horrible and hid several annoying species of monsters. The former wasn't particularly a problem for a chest with no innate sense of smell, and the latter was the main reason it was here in the first place. The mimic scuttled along slowly across the muddy ground, using stealth to minimize its presence. Its normally narrow spider legs were uncharacteristically tipped with small discs that increased their surface area and prevented the monster from sinking into the soft mud. It then suddenly stopped, planted all eight of its legs firmly on the ground, and, for lack of a better term, crouched. The slender black limbs then uncoiled suddenly as Boxy leapt up into the air, reaching a height of about 3 meters. The spidery appendages on its side disappeared back inside its body, and four long, narrow metal rods with pointed ends popped out from its underside. It fell like a brick into a nearby puddle, driving the four oversized nails deep into the ground with a splash, a squish, and a crunch. Assassination skill triggered. Your attack has dealt 350% more damage. Target HP minus 253. Proficiency level increased. Assassination is now level 8. Agility plus 2. Dexterity plus 1. Strength plus 1. The puddle the mimic landed in erupted as a gigantic 3-meter-long gray lobster emerged. It thrashed about wildly, trying to shake off the stubborn box that had nailed itself to its back. But it couldn't because Boxy had already expanded the tips of its makeshift spears to form something akin to fish hooks. It had already firmly anchored itself to the raging crustacean's backside. Its unwilling mount attempted to reach back and pry the damnable box out of its back, but its long, powerful pincers simply could not bend back that far. Boxy opened its jaw and produced two fleshy tendrils wrapped around its favorite shiny things, a pair of mithril daggers. It swung them downwards in a wide arc, easily penetrating the invertebrate monster's outer shell and gouging out its flesh. "You have inflicted a minor stab wound. Target HP minus 84. You have inflicted a minor stab wound. Target HP minus 103. Yet, despite driving them down to the hilt, its attack was still considered a minor stab wound. Relatively speaking, poking something this large with daggers was like stabbing a person with a nail. It would take far more than two strikes to bring down a creature that, based on the shapeshifter's previous experiences, had around 1,500 HP on average. Which was why the mimic withdrew its daggers and struck again and again. You have inflicted a minor stab wound. Target HP minus 136. You have inflicted a minor stab wound. Target HP minus 122. Boxy's assault would do a lot more damage if it could hit anything vital like a heart, neck, lung, or skull, but its current position meant it could only strike at muscle and meat. Then there was the fact that these things seemed to have some sort of defenses which greatly reduced physical damage taken. It was probably due to their combination of passive skills not too dissimilar to the mimic's natural armor. You have inflicted a minor stab wound. Target HP minus 92. You have inflicted a minor scratch. Target HP minus 13. The oversized lobster didn't exactly sit still and let itself be stabbed to death, either. It thrashed about wildly, even going as far as rolling across the ground, which caused some of the thrusting attacks to veer off course and end up as glancing blows. That was just an unintended side effect, though, as what the crabby crustacean was trying to do was shake its attacker off its blind spot. Unfortunately, its efforts only made things worse as it inadvertently drove the stubborn chest's steel legs deeper inside itself. Being squished against mud or submerged in water was not nearly enough to discourage a dangerous mimic of Boxy's caliber, which just kept relentlessly stinging its prey. You have inflicted a minor stab wound. Target HP minus 115. You have inflicted a minor stab wound. Target HP minus 87. Growing desperate, the lobster reared up and threw its head back and sprayed a shower of corrosive acid into the air. The deep green liquid then promptly rained down atop the violent monster currently attached to the invertebrate's back. But Boxy